might mention that I think it was probably mentioned last time those of you were here, and it's obvious that we are sharing our sitting hall with others, or others are sharing their place with us. I don't know which it is, but every December the friends here open their meeting hall here for a bunch of homeless people to come and have a place to stay, and they come in at 9 o'clock, and they go around to 12 different churches in this area, and there's a trailer out in the parking lot there, if you've noticed it, and that transports all the mattresses from one church to the other. And it's very nice. So all 12 months of the year, there's some place where a certain group can go, and it's kind of organized. I think you qualify somehow, and I don't know how exactly it works. And if any of you want to bring on a Thursday some food, they have their dinner at 9 o'clock when they come. So you can. There's a sign-up system for it, but also if you're inspired, you can just bring something. Partly because it gets so complicated out there, and with all the tables and the food and all, we've moved the dana baskets inside, so the two donation baskets are inside, which makes it a little more awkward because it's difficult them to funnel out. But if it's relevant for you, the donation baskets are there. And I don't talk much about the donation system that we have, but it might take just a minute for it. That our understanding of the kind of insight meditation movement, the Theravadan Buddhist movement, the Buddhism that comes from Southeast Asia, is that the Buddhist in the Buddhist tradition for many thousand to 2,500 years, the teachings and the opportunities to practice the meditation practice have been offered as freely or as possible, or freely often. And that was my case when I went to Southeast Asia to practice there. It was really remarkable, the amount of generosity and the amount of support that we were given there to practice. You can go into a monastery, and in the monastery you are given a place to stay, you're given a room, a bed, you're given food, you're given teachings, you're given all the care you need. Usually it's completely for free. And the 8 months I spent in Burma, I felt like I was a guest of the state. Burma is a very poor country, and maybe not a guest of the government, but a guest of the country. And it's a relatively pretty poor country. It's one of the world's poorest countries. And here I was, you know, comparatively an extremely privileged person. And when I came to the meditation monastery in Burma and stayed there, it felt like I didn't need anything. I didn't need any money. I didn't need anything at all, because everything I needed was provided. The best medical care in Burma came to us in the monastery, to the Westerners there, so we didn't have to leave. My filling fell out, and a dentist came to the monastery to see me. And if we needed clothes, we were given clothes. If we needed food, medicine, whatever. And we were given the opportunity to practice. And what was remarkable in Burma was how so many people there were really inspired by practitioners, by people who are doing a meditation practice. And so there was a tremendous desire to support anybody who was practicing. And so as I received all the support, material support that allowed me to practice there so intensely, I had the very strong sense that I wasn't just doing the practice for myself, that I was also doing it in a sense, I was responsible in a sense for those people providing me with support. And it actually inspired me in a joyful way to really throw myself into the practice and do it even more thoroughly than I maybe would have otherwise. It was a beautiful system. And it was all for free. And so many of us, you know, who practiced in Asia came back to America and really wanted to continue that tradition here. Just felt really inspired. And so we didn't want to charge for the teachings or the opportunities to practice. And so it's a little bit odd in America to not charge for things. Americans don't understand it so well. One Burmese monk, Usilananda, who lives in Delhi City, he was going to come and teach a class for us in September. And I suggested he do it on this donation system, because that's what we were used to doing, and that's what, when Western monks come and teach for us, that's what we do. And he said, "Oh, but Americans don't know what that means. We should charge." But in any case, we got him to do it on the old-fashioned system. And And also the story to tell of I met once a Vipassana teacher from Australia, from Perth in Australia, and he was trying to teach people mindfulness and make could support himself off that or whatever. And very few people came, and he wasn't really making it go on it, and he was kind of not really supporting himself. And so he decided, forget this, this free thing. Let's charge. And as soon as he charged, lots of people came. And he had more classes. He had like 12 classes a week, introductory classes, phenomenal. You know, and he just couldn't handle it all himself. So there's something about money that in our cultures, which, you know, we're kind of confused about it and what it means and what. So I think in Australia, the sense was, if you charge for it, there's value to it. And if you don't charge, well, then there's no value. So it is a kind of odd system that we're doing for our culture. But it's an experiment, and we've been doing it for about 20 years, and it's going quite beautifully. I think I like it a lot. I think it keeps everyone honest and straightforward, and it ensures that, in some sense, that people don't... Hopefully, the teachers themselves don't take for granted their support that they get. And also, someone told me recently that she went to some other temple. I think it was actually a synagogue. And there was a required dues, so every Saturday you had to pay. And she comes here, and there's nothing required. And she realized one day that she actually gave the same amount, whether she went to the synagogue or here. But here, because no one's asking, she felt like she was this joy of generosity. She was really happy for what she was doing. Whereas the synagogue was like, you know, a duty. So anyway, so that's a system we have here. A system is a donation system, which means that if you feel inclined or feel inspired to support what we do and support me or whoever the teacher is who comes here, then there's those two baskets up there, and one basket is for the rent, and one basket is for the teacher. And the only way that really allows us to continue doing what we do is by getting supported. But you only get supported by the people who are inspired. So that's kind of nice. And when I get this wonderful money, you know, and support for myself from the basket, I feel it's kind of like sacred money. It's like it's come through a special way. It's come through people's inspired generosity for the support of the practice and for the teacher. And so I'll feel then this money I want to use carefully. I mean, I don't use money for strange things, but anyway. But you know, I kind of feel kind of special about the money. Or if I go to a restaurant, sometimes I'll kind of tip the waiter or waitress a little bit more because I feel like it's kind of all this part of this generous system, and I'm the recipient of generosity, and it's nice to pass it on. And I've been going to this yoga class Tuesday nights. I don't know. I said I would only talk for a minute on this. Maybe it's the talk of the evening. I'm going to this yoga class, and my wife, who's pregnant, signed up for the whole class, the whole series. And I signed up. I just do it on a drop-in basis. And my wife has gotten too pregnant to go, so she didn't go this week. But I went. So I had this, what seems to the instructor and the person who takes care of the registration, a little odd way of behaving. And it comes from the fact that I've been in this scene for so long. So when I come with my... So I pay each time. And what I do is I come with my money in an envelope. And I hand them the envelope. I don't hand them money. I hand them the envelope with the money inside. And because it feels more respectful. Because this is a teacher, a yoga teacher, and he's my teacher. And I want to do something... I don't want to just pay him. I want to respectfully make this offering to him. So I put it in an envelope and I hand them the envelope. Which is kind of... I've been trained in Asia that that's a respectful thing to do. And the person who registers, she's Indian, so she kind of like smiles and kind of recognizes somehow that this is something different. And then this week I came to pay at the end of the class, and she noticed my wife hadn't come, who's paid for the whole series, and they asked, and I said, well, she can't come anymore, she's too uncomfortable. And then she said, oh, well, you don't have to pay then, because your wife, you just take your wife's place. And I said, oh, but my intention today was to come and pay. My intention was to come and give this today. So take it. So she took it for the yoga teacher. So, you know, so I think a little bit differently kind of about money and what it means to support people and what it means to exchange money, partly because I'm in a very unusual economy, an economy of generosity and goodwill. And it's really lovely. Maybe it's a kind of alternative economy that that people don't understand, you know, out there, wherever there is. And it is an experiment whether it's going to work. What happens when we go on retreats? You all seem kind of listening, so I guess it's okay to continue. I'm usually very shy to talk about this, so it's kind of like a talk about generosity. So what we do is, if you go on retreats, like overnight retreats, then we do charge. But the fee is only the fee for what it costs to put on the retreat, the cost of renting the facilities, the cost of the food, the cost of transportation sometimes for some of the people who might have to fly in, the teachers or the cooks. And the staffing of it, the people on staff, which are the teachers and the cooks, don't get paid from that money. There's no money left over, really. And because the idea is that everybody's offering things freely, the staff and the teachers. And so at the end of the retreat, usually there's an envelope to make donations if you're inclined. But if someone's not inclined, there's no requirement. There's one Vipassana tradition, a different one than our own, the Goenka tradition, where I think that it's someone sat Goenka, the Goenka system. Do they kind of not allow you to make a donation the first time?
No. Well, I mean, the donation that you make, they use for the students that come next.
Next time, yeah. So you explain.
It's done at the end.
It's done at the end of. I see. I had this idea that the first time you do a retreat with them, you're not allowed to make a donation, but maybe that's not accurate.
Yeah. At the end, I mean, so
at the end.
They use it for the next
semester. Yeah, so that's
You're there as a result of the generosity of the previous set.
So in that system, it's completely free. There's no, you just show up, and there's no registration, there's no pay for anything. So that's different than our system, where we pay for ourselves, at least the food and the lodging. In the Goenka system, it's completely free. You show up, and then at the end, if you're inclined, you can do something. And what happens is the people who might have a lot of means will donate a lot, and the people who have very little means will donate very little. And sometimes the people who donate very little because they have little means, it's actually a bigger deal for them. It's a bigger sacrifice or whatever. And the people who may give lots of money, it's like, you know, there's a lot of wealth here, right, in this valley. And, you know, someone puts in, you know, $50, you know, it's like toilet paper for them. Someone else puts in a dollar, and it's like it's a major deal for them. So anyway, the idea is that you know, it works out, and people do what they want to do and what they can do and all that. Do you have any questions about any of that? Should I give a talk on generosity instead of the talk I was going to give? Make it up. It's very interesting to me that the traditional teachings of the Buddha, he described a sequential, a progressive path to the spiritual life, or a progressive spiritual path. And a person starts off, you start where you are. You start where you happen to be. And then you kind of build the qualities of spiritual life. You build the kind of insights and until they get stronger and stronger, until you have a kind of liberative awakening experience. And you can imagine, perhaps, this is the way Ajahn Amaro described it. You can imagine that, you know, the Buddha is sitting under a tree, which he often did in India, and he would receive anybody who happened to come for teachings or to hang out with him. And there was completely open system. Anybody could come, anybody could wander in. And there'd be a whole range of types of people who'd come. There'd be farmers, and there'd be prostitutes, and there'd be wealthy merchants, and there'd be businessmen, and there'd be rulers. And in the scriptures, they talk about this huge, the whole cross-section of the culture of India at the time would come visit him. And they have these conversations, and some of these conversations are recorded. And some people would be quite well-developed intellectually or spiritually, and some people would have almost no background in anything, and they were soldiers or butchers. And in Buddhist culture, a butcher is considered to be spiritually kind of ignorant, not so well developed, because butchery, killing animals, is not considered to be very appropriate spiritual livelihood. But so he would kind of talk where people are at, meet them where they were at. And for people who were living unethical lives, he would talk about ethics. And people who were already living an ethical life and were able to kind of get concentrated, he'd talk about concentration. And he would start where people are at, and then he kind of lead them sequentially to the goal of Buddhist practice, which is the experience of liberation. But what's in this sequential path of spiritual development, what's interesting is that it begins with generosity. The first practice the Buddha teaches as a foundational practice for the Buddhist practice is the practice of generosity. And we might ask, you know, why is that? I might ask you, why do you think that? Why would the Buddha, or why would any spiritual teacher, recommend that the first spiritual practice, is the foundation for spiritual life, is the practice of generosity? Why do you think?
Yeah.
It has to do with letting go. So there's something about what is it about letting go that has to do with spirituality, with developing an awakened, compassionate life?
Well, the antithesis of that would be clinging.
Uh-huh.
And at whatever level that occurs, there's bound to be an impediment to liberation, to freedom.
And the reason, partly because the definition of freedom in Buddhism is a state that doesn't cling. So as we learn non-clinging through the act of generosity, we're actually cultivating, strengthening that capacity of non-clinging, which is in some sense the goal of Buddhist practice. That's nice. Yeah.
Perhaps because sharing furthers the concept of non-self.
Well, that's nice. So how so?
Well, because by generally spreading good, everything is happier.
So generosity furthers the Buddhist idea of no self, or put it a little bit differently, like Terry talked about, that part of the problem, one of the barriers to a full, awakened, and compassionate life is our clinging to a sense of self, or clinging to me and mine, or things that are mine. And as long as we're clinging to this is mine, it's very hard to be free. So if you start being generous with the things that you have and not cling to it so tightly, then you cultivate this experience of no self. And one of the beautiful things about generosity is that it does connect us to other people. So one of the things, maybe some of you were going to say this, but the fact that it's a spiritual practice, the first spiritual practice you do is a practice that puts you in a relationship to other people. Isn't that nice? So often we think of Buddhists, you know, kind of they're sitting there kind of contemplating their navel, right, by themselves in a cave, you know, and they're kind of, you know, withdrawn from the world and asocial, and aren't we? So, but anyway, the first practice is a practice that actually puts you in relationship to other people. So it teaches a lot about our relationship to other people, the amount of self, the amount of clinging, the amount of posturing, the amount of connection we feel with others, the amount of heartfelt connection. There's a lot that goes on, and I think it's very significant that we begin our spiritual life, in a sense, cultivating something which is both good for ourselves, but also good for others, and also establishes a richer connection between us. I think it's very important, I think, to realize that our spiritual practice is not something we do just for ourselves, but we do for the sake of others also. What other things do you think? Why is generosity so listed first? Yes. Yes.
What is the definition of generosity in Buddhism, in the sense that you know, someone who $50 is toilet paper and gives lots of $50 away, versus someone where a dollar is a lot and gives it away? I mean, is there a sense of having to feel that you're giving out something?
That is a sacrifice. No. This idea of sacrifice is not a Buddhist one. One of the criteria that Buddha gave for when you should give, be generous, when you should do this generous act, is that he said the joy of the giver should be greater than the joy of the recipient. If your joy is going to be greater than that of the recipient, then it's a good idea. You should give. So rather than being a self-sacrificing thing, in a sense, it's actually also a joyful thing. And one of the reasons, I think, that it's first, there's many reasons, but is that joy is a very important quality for Buddhist spiritual life. And so to do things that bring joy actually helps further one's spiritual practice, makes it easier. So the idea of sacrifice is not so important. However, if we look at it the other way, rather than looking at it as sacrifice, the other side of that is stinginess. If a person gives, but there's stinginess, if there's not this really sense of heartfelt wanting to help or give or be generous, then that doesn't develop these qualities of non-clinging, letting go, of generosity, of joy. So the person who gives away $50 might not, it might actually be stingy for that person. Whereas someone who gives a dollar might be incredibly generous. There's one sutra, one scripture, where there's a wealthy man who is inspired by the Buddha and kind of becomes a follower of the Buddha and decides to do this, to be generous to people who are homeless and things like that. But he's stingy. So he chooses the worst food that he can find, that he has in his storerooms, and the worst clothes that are kind of ripped and whatever he has. But then he instructs his attendant to give it away. So as the kind of Buddhist economics works on merit, so the idea was that, so it goes on to explain that the wealthy man certainly got some good merit from this, but his attendant, who gave it away, and actually he wasn't his in a sense, but he gave himself, he was much more generous and outgoing, giving away his master's wealth, his master's stingy gifts, he actually developed much more merit. So it's a quality of the giving that's important. It's also interesting that the Buddha gave a list of who you should give to. And there's the list starts with you should give to your friends and family. And I thought that's also significant. There's a tendency in Buddhism to really honor the place we were at. And so to really take the good qualities we have, like loving ourselves or loving our friends or our family, and starting there and strengthening that, and then expanding beyond that to include other people, to include strangers, include even your enemies. So loving kindness practice is done that way. Kind of you take something and universalize it. You don't deny yourself. You don't deny the kind of sense of love you might have towards others in your close by. But you don't limit it there. Usually the problem is that it's limited. You expand it, you universalize it. So same thing with generosity. You start with the people close at hand, the people you might feel close to. And then as a practice, you begin universalizing it. So the list starts with family and friends, and then it goes to people in need. People who are poor or homeless or whatever. And then you give to... The third category is you give to spiritual people. You give to, which in ancient India meant, people who are spiritual people in ancient India meant people who had renounced the world and were living entirely, being supported entirely by the donations of people. So they wandered around, did their practice, and were supported for it. Anyway, so again, as I keep saying, I think it's very significant that generosity is the foundation for the Buddhist spiritual life. And it can be, for some people, a practice in its own right. I had a friend who, because of psychological difficulties, very severe difficulties, wasn't able to continue with her meditation practice anymore. So she went to her teacher. And her teacher told her that she kind of stopped doing the meditation practice, and rather she should only practice generosity. That should be her practice. And she blossomed in it. She softened, her heart opened, there was more joy, more sense of connection with other people. She got to see there were lots of opportunities to be generous. There's an infinite number of opportunities to be close-hearted. Right? And there's as many opportunities to be generous as there are opportunities to be close-hearted. So she learned it was generous to offer a smile to someone. And sometimes it's a very generous thing to ask someone how they are. It's a very generous thing to, you know, there's all kinds of small things that can be done. It doesn't have to be a major thing. It doesn't have to be things at all. It can be with our presence, our attention. I'm fond, very fond of, you know, some of you know words. I'm fond of words. I think words are kind of fascinating, their origins and stuff. But the word, the ways in which we use the word give in English, we say give way on the freeway. You know, someone's kind of wants to get into your lane, you give way. And usually, you know, the word give, right, means it's actually an opportunity for generosity. You know, you generously allow them to come into your lane. Or you give your attention to someone. You know, I mean, so think every time you hear the word give your attention to someone. Give up is a good one. I like that a lot because give up, apparently, in its origins, meant to offer up as an offering to the altar or something. It's like a sacred offering. So it isn't like surrender originally. Originally it was to offer up something. So to give up is to offer it. Here, you can have it as an offering. A friend of mine was held up at knife point in outside the projects in San Francisco at night. And another friend walked by them. And later they both met inside where they're both going. And the first friend said, I was being held up. And the second guy said, well, I didn't notice. What was going on? Because you guys were in a conversation. I gave him my wallet and said, you can have my money. But said, you know, actually, I need to get home and I need a couple of dollars just to keep for myself. And so we had this conversation back and forth about how much he could take and how much I needed. And I don't exactly recommend that, you know, always. But he was a Zen priest who had been practicing for years, and there's a certain presence of mind, a certain sense of generosity, a certain sense of not taking things too personally and not getting angry or upset or afraid, you know, right off the bat. And so he kind of thought, oh, okay, this, you know, I don't know what he thought, but okay, this guy's asking me for it, I'll give it up, I'll offer it up. But, you know, I also need some of it. And, you know, maybe he was really lucky that he found some guy who was reasonable. But it's a great story, isn't it? And Jack Kornfield, Jack Kornfield says he has a practice of whenever he has a generous thought, he has a practice to act on it. Within reason, of course, I guess. But if he has, if he thinks, oh, I'd like to give this to someone, he then acts on it or at least thinks about it seriously. And I think that's a great practice. And I did that for a while, kind of for a few days, kind of letting that kind of be a practice or a sense. And what surprised me was how seldom I wanted to be generous. And I'm not saying that because, you know, I'm confessing I'm a terrible person. I'm not such a great person, but I'm not terrible. But, you know, I'm so, I'm just whatever I am. But it surprised me that it wasn't like I wanted to be generous left and right all the time. So this idea of, you know, of having a practice to act on any motivation, generosity, probably is not going to make you bankrupt. And what's interesting, when you take on generosity as a practice, is that you might be generous, you might start giving in situations you don't feel comfortable about giving, or you might feel afraid to give, or you might feel all kinds of questions might arise, all kinds of emotions and feelings might arise. And part of the value of giving as a practice is to bring up all those feelings and thoughts. So you get to look at that really well. Look at how you might be afraid of giving away your money. Look at how you want to hold on to things. Look at who you decide to give to and who you're not deciding to give to, and the questions and fears and all. And to really, to clarify that and look at that in a really deep way, I think is very useful. There's all these great stories. And Nagarjuna was a famous Buddhist teacher of the past. And the story of him, You know, the Buddhist monks have these bowls that they do the alms around bit with, and they're much bigger than this, but they're about this shape, and they kind of walk around, people put food in it or whatever. And because he was a famous teacher, some king had given him in a very precious, maybe solid gold or something, bowl, which he didn't care for, but then here he had it. And he was sleeping one night out someplace in under a tree, and a robber came along and saw this gold bowl. Now, robbers like gold, right? So he was kind of sneaking up to get the gold bowl, and just before he got to it, he stepped on a branch or something, and Nagarjuna woke up. And so Nagarjuna realized what was going on, and he picked up the bowl and gave it to him. Yeah, you can have it. And so the robber went off, and then he came back the next morning and said, such an act of generosity just blew me away. I couldn't understand how someone can do it. It really moved me. I've come back to be your disciple, to be your student. That's a nice story. And then there's a story of from the Christian tradition that I've read sometimes. Anastasius, who was one of the desert fathers in Egypt. And he had a Bible. You know, in the old days they had to write it out by hand, and it was, you know, probably beautiful drawings in the margins, and beautiful Bible. And it was worth 18 shekels. And one day a wandering person came into the church or the monastery, and Anastasius took him in and fed him and let him have a night's sleep. But he saw this, you know, rather expensive, fine-looking Bible sitting on the shelf. So in the morning when he was leaving, he took it. And he went into town, into Cairo, and he went to a used bookstore and said, you know, will you buy this? I'm selling it. Would you like to buy it? And the book dealer said, oh, well, this looks like a fine, very fine book, but before I agree to give you some money for it, I want to take it to a friend of mine and ask him, you know, what he thinks of it and how much he thinks it's worth. So he took the book to Anastasius. and he asked, Anastasius said, I'm thinking of offering this man 16 shekels for this book. Do you think that's a good deal? Anastasius looked and said, oh yeah, that's a very good deal. This book is at least worth 18 shekels. And so the book dealer went back to his store and found the thief. And he said, oh, I'm happy to give you 16 shekels for it. And then the thief said, oh, well, how did you decide that? And, well, I went and checked with my friend, Anastasius. And he looked at the book and he thought it was, you know, easily worth 16 shekels. And so the thief said, oh, I'm not selling it anymore. And he took the book and went back to Anastasius and said, you know, I'm so sorry. And he was crying and said, please take it back. And Anastasius said, no, no, you keep it. So he also stayed and became a student of Anastasius. So great stories of kind of generosity and non-clinging. So what are your thoughts about this? What are your thoughts and understandings about generosity? More questions? Yeah, Maria.
I think it's interesting that you brought up the practice of generosity as opposed to a meditation practice, for example. And that you gave examples of generosity that had to do with giving people a smile or sharing something or listening to someone. Because I think we tend to think in terms of money, especially as we get very busy. We're very busy and we want to do something for someone, so we give them money. And we really miss part of the value of that generosity, which is the connection with other people and the interaction from which you really do get more than writing out a check.
Yes, yes.
And I think we don't tend to think that way. I think it's an important thing to remember.
It's very generous, yeah, to give ourselves, to give our attention. It's a generous act. And it's obvious when you look at children. The children thrive when they get attention, and I think we all need attention to some degree. We need attention from ourselves. So when we give our attention to our breath, can it be a generous act? Is it an act of generosity to yourself to pay attention. The Zen Master Dogen said that he said something. He's talking about how it can be non-monetary kind of generosity. He said, "You can even give away the flowers on the mountain." Not that you're going out and picking them all and then kind of giving them to people, but rather you leave them up there. But you say, "Here, you can have those."
Or you call people's attention to them because they've missed it.
Yeah. Yes.
I think once at Spirit Rock, one of the teachers was talking about how dana can be used as a meditation or mindfulness practice to see what arises in you when you're doing it. What are all the thoughts that go through your mind, and what's the emotional undertone?
Exactly. So in that sense, it's a practice. So there's two ways of looking at it. You can look at it as a practice where you that actually help you explore yourself. Or you can see it as an expression, a natural expression of a heart, of a mind, which doesn't cling, which is open and receptive. And it's important sometimes to say that because I think often the feelings and the emotions that arise out of a sensitive heart, an awakened heart, a heart which is kind of more, you know, calm and more open than it would be if we're kind of scattered or distracted. There's a lot of emotions that might come up. But it's not always obvious that we should be expressing that or give a channel to it or a vehicle for it. And it's actually very valuable to give a vehicle or give expression to the emotions, the wholesome emotions and feelings that arise within us as we do a spiritual practice. And I talked about bowing some time ago. And bowing can be a very generous act, I think. Just simply, bowing expresses a lot of different things. But one of the things it can express is that you're meeting the other person at a different place. I don't know if it's deeper exactly, but maybe a deeper place than if you meet them and you shake your hands with them. Shaking hands and bowing each have their own place. I wouldn't want to judge one above the other in a sense. I think bowing is more, in some ways, more generous. It's like you're meeting that which is sacred within the other person. You're kind of bowing, you're kind of generously allowing or seeing or acknowledging something really special about that person or completely about that person. You're putting your whole body kind of together. You shake your hand, it's kind of partial, unless you go like this. It's very nice when people shake your hands with both hands. It's kind of, and then it feels really generous, like they're really there and it's warm. So I don't know. Question? Yeah, that's beautiful. That's a teaching you find in almost all spiritual traditions, as far as I know. The idea that the gift returns to the giver twice or three times, or just simply returns. There was an anthropological study the Peloponnesian Islands, where they have gift giving is a big-time deal. It used to be, at least before modern times. And they would give tremendous amount of their goods, shells and basket or whatever they made, to the island that it was down current from them or downwind from them. And then that island would do the same thing to the people who were down current from them. So it was all seemed like, you know, away, everything was going away from you. But if you followed the current or the trade winds or whatever, it made a big circle. And so eventually it came back. But it wasn't obvious. It took a long time. And then another story, which I thought was kind of interesting. I don't know quite what to do of this, but a study on generosity. This was the Maoris in New Zealand, where they would be hunters, and they go into the forest to hunt. And then they would give part of their hunt to the priests. And the priests would go and take part of that and return it as an offering to the forest. So the question was, why couldn't the hunters have done it themselves? Just taken, gone hunting, cut up the animal and left some of it for the forest. And the argument is, by the anthropologist, is that when you have that kind of one-on-one relationship, it can feel all too easy like it's an exchange. But if you give it, if the priest is the intermediary, then it's no longer an exchange with the forest. And it's more of an act of generosity, in a sense, and then a caregiving back into the forest. So I don't know exactly, that's about the best I can explain it, but I thought it was a very interesting idea, that if you have some way of taking the generosity outside of a direct relationship, and it becomes more, it doesn't become an exchange, it becomes a, maybe has, you know, some kind of different meaning. Yes?
The generosity part, I think there's sort of a very human failing of giving but then expecting something in return. And I mean, going back to your freeway example, I'm sure we've given way to somebody to come into the lane and somewhat pissed off that when that person doesn't acknowledge that we have given way. And so the entire act of generosity is now fouled by an expected reaction that didn't happen. And I think we do that many times.
Yes.
And just sort of not focusing on the act of giving is what's there, not the expected return.
Beautiful. That's very beautifully stated. You know, the bumper sticker we see these days, it says, practice random acts of kindness. I think the Buddhist version of that is practice secret acts of kindness. Because if it's secret, then you're not concerned, secret or private or whatever, about the exchange. It should really be, again, and also the saying the Buddha said, your joy should be greater than the recipient, implies that you're really doing it not for anything in return, but really because it's, you know, you're inspired. Yeah.
Having just come back from a retreat, the best advice, at least at this point, the best advice that I've received upon integrating coming back was that someone said, you have to let go of the retreat, and as events and things start to happen that feels like it's taking the retreat away from you, just give it away. Just give it away. And I've done that a number of times this week, and it's been really wonderful. I mean, I don't know if the other people are getting anything out of it, but I am.
So you feel your calm disappearing. And so rather than being upset about, oh, my calm, you know, I had all 17 days of retreat, and I huffed and puffed, and I got some peace finally in my life, I deserve it. Oh, now it's going, and it's terrible. And you feel your peace going, you say, take it. May it be for the benefit of the world. Like that? Beautiful. So should we give some attention to ourselves or to our breath? End with a little sitting?